Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, March 3rd, 2013. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. The University of Arkansas Fort Smith's 32nd season of entertainment presents 102 Years of Broadway, Tuesday, March 5th at 7:30 p.m. at the Fort Smith Convention Center. 102 Years of Broadway recreates the greatest moments from shows such as The Phantom of the Opera, Les Mis, Cats, Jesus Christ Superstar, and more. Tickets and more information available at uafs.edu.
Support for KUAF comes from the EurekaSprings.org website, a guide for shopping, art galleries, historic tours, and spas. The site also includes information on horseback riding, canoeing, hiking, and other outdoor activities. On the web at EurekaSprings.org.
Ahead on Weekend Ozarks, celebrating both archaeology and the American Red Cross this month.
But first, the Arkansas General Assembly is far from convening, but the legislature has completed 6 weeks in session at the state capitol. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis has this review of what lawmakers have been working on this past week.
Governor Mike Beebe started the past week in Washington, D.C. While he was away, Lieutenant Governor Mark Darr was acting governor, and Darr used his authority as acting governor to sign into law a bill making a list of concealed weapons permits secret.
It would go into effect Monday. The governor had a chance to sign it. He chose not to. This is something that was going to become law anyway, but I just felt the need to. I think it's a good piece of legislation, and I think it deserved a signature on it.
BB's spokesman Matt DeCampbell says it took the governor by surprise.
It is not a signing that Governor Beebe condones. He, of course, worries about precedent. This is the first time this has happened in our this is now the beginning of our seventh year in office, and the first we've heard of it for quite some time, even before that.
The bill would have become law with or without a signature, since Beebe didn't veto it, but Darr wanted to put it into effect immediately. Beebe says the lieutenant governor embarrassed himself by doing this.
I will be much more careful about what we do and when we do it. You got to be careful not turn your back if things like that are going to happen, because I owe it to the people. I mean, you know, they elect me to be the governor, and we know what a lieutenant governor is. It's a part-time job. He presides over the Senate, and if something happens that the governor is dead or incapacitated seriously, then that's what that's for.
Lieutenant Governor Darr has stood by his actions, saying that he respects the citizens of Arkansas and the 130,000 citizens that are now protected under this law. Meanwhile, Arkansas House Majority Leader Bruce Westerman, a Republican from Hot Springs, brought his controversial bill to cap state spending back up in House committee early last week. The bill already went through committee but failed to be amended in the House. Westerman says he's been researching other successful spending cap legislation.
I spent a lot of time over the weekend looking at how other states have done spending caps. There are over 30 states that have some kind of a spending cap in place. I'm still looking at data and haven't made up my mind for sure if I will file another amendment on it.
The bill was amended by the House Revenue and Tax Committee. Westerman says the bill is not a spending cap, but merely a way to rein in government growth. The amendment now ties the spending cap to the average rate of disposable personal income in the state, rather than to a formula that would limit the state budget growth to 3% or less. Westerman says the bill's new formula will give the state incentive to keep taxes low.
I believe this is a great indicator, and I believe it works both ways. I think this will allow us to responsibly control the growth of government spending. It's a much simpler method of doing the calculation.
Disposable personal income refers to an individual's total income after paying taxes. The bill has passed committee once before, but House members refused to amend it. The governor and the Department of Finance and Administration have spoken against the bill. We now go from cuts in spending to cuts in taxes. Arkansas Speaker of the House Davey Carter this week called on lawmakers to make $150 million in tax cuts this session. The Republican from Cabot visited the House Judiciary, Public Health, and Revenue and Tax Committees, reminding each committee of the time frame of the legislative session. In the Tax Committee, he told lawmakers he was counting on them to wade through the over $2 billion in tax cuts that they have before them in a timely manner.
Mr. Chairman, I'm asking that the committee begin deliberations on your tax cut package in the total amount of $150 million.
Governor Mike Beebe told reporters that lawmakers will have to justify any cuts.
We can't even afford my number one tax cut right now immediately, which is the groceries tax cut, and still meet these obligations. So if they're going to cut any more taxes, they have an obligation to say who they're taking it from.
Speaker Carter also proposed cuts to the state's capital gains tax. The governor said he is working with the speaker on those types of tax cuts. In other news from the state legislature, the Arkansas Senate voted Thursday morning to override Governor Mike Beebe's veto of a bill that would ban most abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy.
By a vote of 19 yeas, 14 nays, you have overridden the veto.
The House also voted to override the veto, meaning the bill became law immediately. The only exception to the 20-week abortion ban would be for causes of rape, incest, and the health of the mother. Ruth Mims, executive director of Arkansas Right to Life, was in the Senate chamber for the vote and offered an immediate reaction.
It's wonderful news. I mean, and that law takes effect immediately. So unborn children 20 weeks in the past are going to be protected in Arkansas.
Governor Beebe had vetoed the bill earlier in the week, saying he believed it violated the U.S. Constitution. After the Senate vote, he told reporters,
I've told you my concerns, and the concerns still exist, but the legislature has the final say. That's a constitutional process.
The American Civil Liberties Union had said that if the bill became law, it would file suit, meaning a court would eventually determine the constitutionality of the law. Seven other states have similar laws in effect. The state Senate also advanced another abortion bill to Governor Mike Beebe. The legislation would ban most abortions after 12 weeks of pregnancy. Representative Andy Mayberry, a Republican from Hensley, sponsored the 20-week ban and told reporters just outside the Senate chamber the bill has been a personal mission for him.
It's different than some kind of tax cut bill or something like that. This has an immediate effect on the lives of babies.
Abortion rights advocates and the governor have said the bill is unconstitutional, but Mayberry says he's not too concerned there will be legal challenges because similar 20-week abortion bans in other states are already being challenged in court, and any decision there would likely apply to the Arkansas law. Those challenges may be focused at the 12-week ban because it would likely be the most restrictive abortion law in the country. Jill June, CEO of Planned Parenthood of the Heartland, which operates Planned Parenthood clinics in Little Rock and Fayetteville, says the bills are a surprising blow to women's health in the state.
It's a shocking disregard for the Constitution and the women of the state of Arkansas. And yes, I was deeply shocked and saddened to see that the legislature had sunk to this new low.
Though the governor vetoed the 20-week ban, he wouldn't tell reporters what his plans were for the 12-week ban.
I'm not going to tell you any more than I always tell you, which is I'll let you know when I take the action.
The governor generally says he doesn't talk about vetoes until he makes them, but he has said he thinks it's more unconstitutional than the 20-week ban. However, with Thursday's vote, the governor's veto likely won't prevent the more restrictive law from taking effect. From the Herald and Blanche Kalk News Studio, I'm Timothy Dennis, and this is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And joining us now is Dan Kraft, Special Projects Reporter with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Hi, guys.
Good morning. Hello. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So you have a big story in today's paper.
Yeah, we've tried to take a look at a report that was put out a couple of weeks ago by the Walton Family Foundation, which is the philanthropic arm of the family behind Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
They look sort of at quality of life in Northwest Arkansas based on a number of factors, everything from how safe do you feel in your neighborhood to traffic congestion, quality of schools, that kind of thing. But what we focused on this time was the portion of the report where we're looking at the amenities in Northwest Arkansas, the museums, the concert venues, the trails, the baseball and other sports teams, things that people do use. I'm looking at a little bit of breakdown of who uses what and the wish list that the survey respondents said they'd like to see more of in Northwest Arkansas.
So what do people use the most? What amenities, what places?
It actually tends to depend on where you live and where these amenities are. Proximity did seem to play a role in a lot of things. Obviously, the Walton Arts Center, based in Fayetteville, brought in more folks from Fayetteville and some from Springdale than Macon County did. Crystal Bridges up in Bentonville was the opposite. You know, the folks closer to home tended to use them a little bit more, although they do all pull from little bit, at least, from across the region.
Sure. The region's small enough that you could get to the Walton Arts Center from Bentonville, you know, just as easily as you could get to Crystal British from Fayetteville.
Sure. One of the complaints that folks did identify in another portion of the report was, you know, obviously they don't like the traffic congestion, but
well, sure.
Everybody did say if we could get there quicker or easier, they think they would pull from a wider audience.
Interesting.
So another interesting point, the Arvis Ballpark, where the Naturals play, is just about dead center in the region.
Right.
And talking with Eric Edelstein, their manager, the receipts that they've looked at from ticket sales based on zip code, they pull almost evenly from Bentonville, Rogers, Springdale, Fayetteville, and even a portion from Siloam.
From Siloam? Baseball fans, then, in Siloam.
Right, and that's... I mean, but it's not that far. I mean, I think of Siloam being a little further, but I think of it based
it
like, from
further.
Rogers or something. But if you're in Springdale, that's,
if you're right there at 412.
Right, 412, it's really not that much of a drive.
Exactly. Yeah. And in talking with Eric about some of the other things people would like to see, professional sports teams, more of them, depending on how you say professional.
Professional, right.
A lot of people would like to see that. Obviously, you can build a baseball stadium cheaper than you can, say, a football or stadium or a basketball
right.
arena.
Yes.
But some of those other minor leagues aren't in great shape right now. Some of them require a little more population to support.
Right.
But one of the other things people identified was an additional outdoor amphitheaters or music. There's a good possibility, if they could work it around the baseball schedule, he said, that, you know, the baseball field could be turned into a sizable music venue.
I hadn't thought about that.
I really hadn't. Have there ever been music events at the baseball field?
Not sizable ones,
okay.
Although they've had all sorts of non-baseball events from luncheons to political events there before.
Right.
They have fundraisers there often for different things in the community.
And obviously one of the other popular music venues, the AMP, the Arkansas Music Pavilion, sitting out at the fairgrounds of Washington County. They do tend to pull more from Washington County than Benton County. But they're looking for a permanent home, and their biggest concern is access from 540, and it could end up in not necessarily in Fayetteville. It could be anywhere along
the
corridor.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that.
Interestingly enough, one thing they looked at was the Jones Center, and a lot of these things that the report focused on were areas where the foundation has provided money to support these things in the past or, you know, may in the future.
Oh, that makes sense. They want to know.
Exactly. One of the things they looked at was the Jones Center. And that's a variety of recreational opportunities, not necessarily sports-based. But it was really designed to serve a lower-income and a more localized population. They think it is doing that. But they've got one thing there that seems to blow the proximity argument out of the water, and that's their ice rink.
Right.
They pull – that ice rink is used by people from all across the region simply because
– it's the only one.
You got it.
Right.
Right, because the Razorback hockey team plays there.
Right, and I think that don't they have like intramural hockey and stuff
yes.
as well? Yeah.
Well, hockey may not
skating.
Be a huge draw in terms of sports in the South. It for the folks that are dedicated to it, that is the only place they can play this side of Central Arkansas.
Well, what else? Was there anything else that people wanted?
The things that they listed out as things they'd like to see, one of them was mass transit. Some of that, we actually have a lot of road projects ongoing that will increase access to a lot of these places. They'd mentioned that they'd like to see more flights to more destinations out of XNA and cheaper. You know, I think they'd like to go to Hong Kong for $100 direct. But in talking with the airport folks, yeah, they're trying to land another discount carrier. They're always looking at adding more destinations.
Well, surely the recent expansion has to, you know, help.
And they do think that will help land another discount carrier, which is where they see the growth.
Because right now their discount carrier is Legend.
Right. The other part of mass transit, though, obviously some people have talked about the bus system, Ozark Regional Transit, and to some extent Razorback. Voters really shot the additional funding for that down pretty hard in November.
Right. Yes,
but
they
did. Is still
right.
something that they expanded bus service is probably a more realistic goal than, say, light rail, which is prohibitively expensive and requires a certain population density that
we just don't have.
And they don't think we'll have it anytime soon. Anyway, we looked through that report and found quite a few different aspects, and you know, some of them will show up in other stories that appear in the paper over the next few weeks and months. But when we saw the amenities break down and sort of the wish list, there were some surprises. I didn't think the outdoor amphitheater would be the top, you know, choice among people that they surveyed, but it was, I think, 2 out of 3.
Oh,
that
wow.
was something they wanted to see. And so we decided to try and take a look and see what plans there were or possibilities there were out there for some of these things to happen.
Okay. And they'll find your, we can find your whole report in today's paper?
Yeah. Okay. The 4 Northwest Arkansas Dailies. That's okay. The Benton County Daily Record, the Morning News in Rogers and Springdale, and the Northwest Arkansas Times in Fayetteville.
Okay.
Thank you, Dan.
Appreciate it.
Dan Kraft is Special Projects Reporter for Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
March is National Red Cross Month. To draw awareness to that organization, what it is, and what it does, I traveled to Tawnytown, where the Northwest Arkansas chapter has its office. I spoke with Jeff Patrick. He's Director of Communications for the Red Cross. He began by telling me the organization's purpose.
The Red Cross across the country provides disaster assistance to victims of single-family fires, tornadoes, wildfires, floods, earthquakes, and then man-made disasters. So in that, we provide sheltering, we provide food, clothing, assistance in that nature. We provide assistance to make sure they get back on their feet and that they have everything they need for the next 2 to 3 days. And then in any longer disaster like a tornado, a flood, one of the bigger operations, we'll open shelters, we'll have fixed and mobile feeding across the community, and then we'll work with community partners to do referrals and make sure that they're taken care of in the long-term recovery. We also provide preparedness and health and safety training to businesses, schools, churches, and individuals.
These are all things that you do with this local chapter, the Northwest Arkansas chapter. So you're holding babysitter trainings and CPR training. So you could give me CPR training right now?
Yeah, I'm an instructor.
Okay. So you mentioned that you respond to single family house fires every day.
Yeah. Every day in across Arkansas, we have our disaster responders that are responding to 5 family fires. And what they do in that case is we get a call from the fire department, the fire chief, the client themselves, or it may be referred through another agency. And we go out a lot of times during the fire. When they're still fighting the fire, the family's still on site, and we go out and provide emotional support first thing, make sure that they're okay. And then we also are able to put them in a hotel if they need a place to stay. A lot of folks will stay with family and friends. They'd rather be with people that they know and love. But if they need a place to stay, we can put them in a hotel. Then we also provide financial assistance to make sure they get new sets of clothes, food, medications. We can provide referrals to get glasses, and then other medical necessities that they lost in that fire.
So you say we. Who is we? Who is going out there when you get the phone call from the fire department?
We have trained volunteers that are everyday people. A lot of folks are like, well, I can't volunteer with the Red Cross. I don't have the experience or the training. We have people from all walks of life. We have married couples, young professionals, college students, and then a lot of just general adults.
Again, you say we get the call and they, the volunteer. How many people actually work just in this Northwest Arkansas office? And then how many volunteers does it take to actually make the Red Cross run?
You know, we have probably 8 to 10 staff members. And those will be either staff members that are chapter or that work across the state, like our disaster managers are regional staff. And then we also have national staff here at the office that work in our preparedness and health and safety services. So it's a hodgepodge of folks across chapter, regional, and national. And then we have about 250 volunteers in our chapter that respond throughout their communities. And they'll be out doing things like single family fires, but then also helping us with outreach, training, because all the volunteers have to have required training depending on the position they want to hold.
You, as the communications director, do you also have training, and do you ever get out in the field?
Yeah, that's the fun part. Being in communications, I get to have my finger in everything. So I'm a CPR instructor. I support Red Cross clubs. Just last week, I was at the U of A teaching a CPR class to students. Get out in the field, especially when we have a tornado or a flood or a high-level apartment fire.
When it's all hands on deck.
When it's all hands on deck. Because what I'll do is go out and meet with the media, work with reporters, radio, TV, be running social media from the scene, letting people know what we're doing, what's available, and what's needed. And then also, we have folks that deploy all over the country. I deployed recently to Hurricane Sandy in November and worked on the National Disaster Public Affairs Team. So I was working out in Staten Island and all throughout New York and New Jersey to help tell the Red Cross story.
Can you tell me a little bit about that experience, being in Staten Island?
Yeah. It was my first time to deploy, almost with the Red Cross for 4 years, and got the opportunity to go down to Staten Island. Stayed out there for about a week, and then worked in Manhattan for about a week. In Staten Island, we went out to a community called New Dorp, right on the coast. You know, where we were at a multi-agency recovery center, which was, you could see the water right there at Miller Field, and we're working with community partners to make sure that folks had food, blankets, heater meals, cleanup kits, and also got to see the generosity of New York. All their food trucks came out to provide food for free. So the ones that you also saw in Times Square were out in Staten Island providing food and making sure that those folks had the comforts that they needed.
So house fires are hard to predict, and often the severity of a storm like Hurricane Sandy or a tornado are hard to predict, but often meteorologists can predict that something's coming. If you know that something could potentially get bad, do you take precautions?
Yeah, we're always out in the community teaching disaster preparedness education, because getting prepared for any type of disaster is basically the same. Making sure that you have water, non-perishable food items, pop-top cans or cans that you can open with a manual can opener, copies of documents, birth certificates, marriage license, bank information, just in case either you have to evacuate or you have to relocate to a shelter or things to where you have all those essentials. And we do. Red Cross is always on. We're not always on alert or standby, but we're always ready. Luckily, we do work with the Weather Channel, with our National Weather Service, to see when hurricanes are brewing, when winter weather's coming in. Like a day or two after Joplin hit, we had tornadoes in Denning and Cincinnati. And we actually had shelters open in Ozark and Clarksville. And we're there for many weeks working with individuals to, you know, make sure they had a place to stay, make sure we had mobile and fixed feeding out in the community.
Well, as we have, it's March, and March is National Red Cross Month, and you are starting a fundraising campaign?
Yeah, we've got a campaign we're launching second year across Arkansas. It's called Every Red Cent Counts, Be a Hero for the Red Cross. So what we're doing now is mobilizing volunteers, county and city officials, and individuals and businesses to be a hero for the Red Cross. A lot of people think that Red Cross is a government agency and that we have a direct line to the government with funding. What we do have is a congressional charter saying that we will shelter, feed, and help those in need following a disaster, and that we'll provide emergency services to our military families and service members. But that doesn't come with an automatic income every month. So it's the generosity of our communities and the people across our state, region, and country that are able to help us do our mission. We can't do it without donor dollars, without volunteer time. So March is Red Cross Month is a great opportunity for us, with Every Red Cent Counts, to bring a heightened awareness. And then on April 4th, we have our Hero Day, and that's going to be locations across Northwest Arkansas in the River Valley where people can come get more information about Red Cross and then donate some money if they'd like to help. And those locations are being secured now, and they'll be out throughout the community on April 5th.
So Every Red Cent, will we see, things that at like cashiers or, you know, checkout places to kind of put our change, you know, every red cent. That's what I was envisioning.
Absolutely. You know, what we do, we partner a lot with Walmart. Walmart is a national partner of the Red Cross. We partner with them for storefronts. We're also doing an event on March 24th at Fiesta Square in Fayetteville. The vendors there are coming together to support the Red Cross, having activities there in the shopping center, and then also giving the public an opportunity to come and see what we have to offer and support us.
When I pulled up to your office here in Tawnytown, I saw a sign that said blood services. Mm-hmm. So you also...
Yeah, Red Cross collects nearly half the blood supply in the country, 40%. And in Northwest Arkansas, in Tawnytown, we do on the first and third Mondays from 1 to 6 here at the office. We do blood collections, but then there's also mobile blood drives all throughout the community. Trainings are provided for free to the volunteer.
And people can find out more?
You can find out more at redcross.org/Arkansas.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thank you.
Jeff Patrick is Director of Communications for the Northwest Arkansas Chapter of the American Red Cross. And March is National American Red Cross Month. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
In neighboring Oklahoma, the southern section of the controversial Keystone XL oil pipeline is under construction. The northern section awaits permitting by the Obama administration. When completed, the Keystone XL will transport a thick type of crude oil mined from tar sands in Alberta, Canada, to refineries along the Gulf Coast. Proponents say the project is central to U.S. energy independence, will stimulate manufacturing, and create jobs. Opponents say the pipeline threatens the environment and is all about oil industry exports and profits. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
The Alberta-Canada Oil Sands Preserve is one of the largest such deposits in the world. Behemoth earth movers strip mine the sand and extract bitumen. It's a tar-like substance using steam and hot water. Bitumen's diluted with natural gas liquid condensates into a thick substance industry calls dilbit, diluted bitumen, for transport via rail tankers or pressurized pipe to oil refineries to be processed primarily into diesel fuel. International and U.S. oil producers are all heavily invested in the Alberta oil sands. TransCanada, an Alberta-based oil transport and distribution corporation, was permitted in 2006 to install Keystone 1, a 1,000-mile-long, 30-inch cast steel pipeline to deliver dilbit to refineries in southern Illinois. From there, a second 300-mile pipeline extends to Steel City, Nebraska, then on to Cushing, Oklahoma, a historic oil processing, storage, and shipment hub. But to accommodate a surge in dilbit, as well as U.S. fracked shale oil, TransCanada seeks to build a new 1,900-mile-long, $5.3 billion pipeline, parallel to the other, called Keystone XL, down to the Gulf Coast. Permitting of the northern section is currently blocked by the Obama administration because of environmental concerns, but a critical 500-mile stretch from Cushing, Oklahoma, to the Gulf Coast was permitted to proceed last summer. David Dodson is spokesperson for TransCanada's Gulf Coast project.
We're roughly halfway through with the pipeline component from, as you say, from Cushing, Oklahoma to Nederland, Texas. We also are well underway on 6 pump stations and on some operational storage facilities in Cushing.
The U.S. Department of Transportation Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration regulates common carrier oil and gas pipelines. Considered a public utility with absolute rights of eminent domain, as such, TransCanada is entitled to and negotiates perpetual easements with private, state, and federal government landholders. The pipeline will require more than 820,000 tons of steel pipe, primarily sourced, Dodson said, from multinational corporations. Russian-based Evraz operating in Saskatchewan and India-based Wellspun with factories in Arkansas will provide both manufactured pipe and raw steel. But with the Northern Keystone XL section stalled, U.S. Senator John Bozeman recently expressed his concern to congressional colleagues. Here's some tape.
It's important to my home state because many businesses, many hardworking Americans living there would benefit tremendously. We have a large Nucor plant. That Nucor plant in Blytheville, Arkansas, in Mississippi County, which supply a lot of the iron that's going to be used in this. We have another facility, Wellspun, tubular. They make oil pipe. They've got 500 miles of this pipe sitting in storage that they produced to go forward, which should be a great thing. The problem is, instead of increasing employment for the future, right now they've had to lay off workers because of the indecision.
TransCanada spokesperson David Dotson confirmed the Southern Pipeline Project will provide 4,000 temporary jobs, 800 of those in Oklahoma. Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon courted Keystone Interstate to help Oklahoma energy producers get product to market, said spokesperson Alex Weintz in an email for this report. He provided Keystone literature, which stated the project would generate $21 million in revenue. A federal environmental study was issued last year on the entire Keystone XL project, finding no significant impact. But opponents worry pipeline leaks will devastate local watersheds. Anthony Swift is an attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council who researches and writes about U.S. petroleum pipeline systems.
I mean, it's basically a mixture of, kind of a semi-solid, what you might call kind of liquid coal, if anything, and it's mixed with very volatile natural gas liquids to get it to flow in a pipeline, but it's still very thick, and it moves in pipelines at, higher temperatures, up to 150 degrees Fahrenheit. And we found that, pipelines moving or transporting product at those sorts of temperatures are much more likely to leak and to have ruptures. And another thing we found is that this substance, once released into the environment, particularly in water bodies, is far more damaging and difficult to clean. There was a recent, 2 years ago, over 2 years ago, there was a spill in the Kalamazoo River in Michigan. And that, was about 1 million gallons of tar sands crude spilled into the river. And spill responders found that their methods for dealing with oil spills didn't work with tar sands. And the end result is, over 2.5 years after the spill, they're still trying to clean it up. 40 miles of the river is contaminated. It's become the most expensive spill for an onshore pipeline in U.S. history.
Using Keystone's published records and federal data provided by the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, the National Resources Defense Council found that the Keystone 1 pipeline leaked 14 times in its first year of operation. And oil spill data generated by that administration indicated that automated online detection systems, like the one Keystone XL will be using, catch only a small portion of petroleum pipeline breaches.
Perhaps more surprising is that they've missed, 4 out of 5 leaks greater than 42,000 gallons in size.
But TransCanada spokesperson David Dotson says the Keystone XL will illustrate best management practices.
Obviously, we are subject to the all current regulations, and those regulations are federal. But we agreed to an additional 57 conditions suggested by the State Department that will add to another measure of safety and environmental protection. And those conditions concern the thickness of the pipe in certain high consequence areas, how deeply we go under waterways with the horizontal directional drills, the coatings on the pipe. And the State Department concluded, and this is their conclusion, that this pipeline will be built to higher standards than any other pipeline in history.
Anti-Keystone American activists claim Canadian boreal forest and peat bog removal to get at tar sands, plus the energy-intensive processing of the material into diesel, are all greatly contributing to climate change. An estimated 35,000 of them marched on Washington, D.C. February 20th, demanding that President Obama reject the Northern Keystone XL. Activists in Oklahoma have also been working to bring public attention to the project.
I had been focused on the tar sands extraction in Canada, and I had no idea that they were trying to get to the Gulf with this thing.
Tribal environmental consultant Earl Hatley works with the Indigenous Environmental Network, assisting Canadian First Nations affected by tar sands extraction and educating Oklahoma and other American Indian tribes along the pipeline route about tar sands transport. He's Cherokee and Delaware. He and a coalition of eco groups tried to stop the Cushing Keystone Project by suing the federal agency which has oversight on pipelines and waterways. That's the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
With 12 violations of the Clean Water Act, and it's sitting in the district court, federal district court in Denver right now, and I assume the judge is waiting for the whole thing to get built before he rules on it.
Earl Hatley is a member of the Great Plains Tar Sands Resistance, allied with the Texas-based Tar Sands Blockade. Last summer, the blockade made national news for physically attempting to stop the pipeline project. But by fall, things got quiet. Ramsey Sprague, spokesperson for the Tar Sands Blockade based in Texas, said that's because TransCanada last October filed a strategic lawsuit against public participation, or SLAP suit, against 28 named defendants.
And they were seeking, by January, they were seeking $5 million in restitution for damages that they claim that we were responsible for.
TransCanada spokesperson David Dotson refutes Sprague's facts and figures.
It was not a slap suit. It was a temporary restraining order that they voluntarily, and I think this is important for your listeners too, the individuals named in the temporary restraining order voluntarily agreed to a permanent injunction. It was their choice. And there was never a slap suit, and there was never a damage claim.
Tar Sands Blockade organizer Ramsey Sprague says the suit was settled in January. Members have agreed to not trespass on TransCanada's claimed easements in both Texas and Oklahoma, effectively ending their civil disobedience campaign. But Sprague says the lawsuit won't stop them.
Yeah, from March 16th to March 23rd, Tar Sands Blockade is calling for a week of action against TransCanada's investors and tar sands profiteers. We've already had about 60 actions that are planned at this point, and many, many more are destined to be happening.
On February 12th, a handful of activists from the Great Plains Tar Sands Resistance were arrested for occupying a pipeline construction site in Seminole County, Oklahoma. The Great Plains Group has not yet been sued by TransCanada. Earl Hatley was on hand for that protest as well, although not arrested. And his perennial message is that the Keystone Pipeline is not about U.S. energy security.
It's not for America. It has nothing to do with us. It's for export. The companies that are extracting it own the refineries in Texas and the markets in the Far East. It's not for us. It was never intended for us.
Even if the Northern Keystone Route is never constructed, the Southern Route, scheduled to be online later this year or next, will, for the first time, open the Canadian tar sands and U.S. fracked oil spigot. Plus, TransCanada and its big sister and biggest competitor, Enbridge, have several major tar sands pipeline networks on the drawing board to service the booming Alberta oil sands preserve, which some liken to Saudi Arabia. And one of their biggest customers, China. To make way, the Canadian government has reportedly clear-cut the permitting process and classified environmentalists who stand in opposition to tar sands pipelines as domestic terrorists. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
It's Sunday, March 3rd, 2013, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And joining us now is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
And while the cat's away, the mice will play, right?
Sure.
Woohoo. We've lost Kyle, so we'll do something ridiculous and talk about Archaeology Month.
Ooh.
How's that for...
Sounds crazy.
How's that for... over the top.
Over the top.
Off the wall. I talked to the gentleman who is, let me find what his title is, Coordinator of Computer Services, GIS, and Archaeogeophysics.
Okay.
At the Arkansas Archaeological Survey, because March is Archaeology Month. Mm-hmm. His name is Jamie Lockhart, and he's the guy that uses cool tools like ground-penetrating radar.
Mm-hmm. That sounds cool.
Which he says looks a lot like when you're doing it, it looks like the crime scene shows on TV. You walk along, you look under the ground. But he's looking under the ground at a place called Cardin Bottoms, which is down by Dardanelle.
Okay.
It was kind of a crossroads for Native American cultures and for some European contact during the period that archaeologists call contact. And so by doing things like the ground-penetrating radar, he can figure out where everything is down to like centimeters.
Oh, wow.
And then the archaeologists can go in and dig in the traditional Curse of the Mummy fashion. Except that they don't have, if they don't want to, they don't have to dig everywhere because they know that this silhouette is a house.
Okay.
So he can see the pattern of the village too. And it's just really fascinating.
So just a gigantic x-ray.
Yeah.
Of what's going on underneath us.
And this place came to notice in the 20s and 30s because the farmers down there were having a hard time. It was a bad time in our history. And they found out that they could dig and find these pots that were made like by Caddo Indians, the Mississippian period, and they could sell them. So a lot of it's already been torn up, but they're finding really interesting new things, finding like trade beads that prove European contact. Really, really interesting. This will be going on for a long time, but he will be speaking as part of Archaeology Month on March 12th at 7 o'clock at the Arkansas Archaeological Survey Office in Fayetteville. It's free. Some other things going on this month. Devil's Den will be doing a guided pioneer home site hike at 10 o'clock on March 9th. They say it's a strenuous 3-mile hike. I'm right out.
Well, it's good to know that ahead of time instead of getting there and, you know, being surprised.
Hobbs State Park will be doing an archaeology boat tour at 1 o'clock today.
A boat tour?
That interests me.
Yeah.
Leaving from Rocky Branch Marina, just like the Eagle Tours, not Eel Tours. Hmm. They'll have a park interpreter who will talk about archaeological sites around Beaver Lake. It's $10 a person. Call for reservation, 789-5000. The Shiloh Museum of Ozark History will have a program on the Northwest Arkansas Land Trust at noon, March 13th. And, of course, they have their exhibit up from the University Museum, Archaeopteryx to Zappos.
I'm sorry, what?
Archaeopteryx to Zappos. She just wanted to see if I could do it again. It's up from 10 to 5 Monday through Saturday all month. And the University of Arkansas at Fort Smith will have a talk on multisensor remote sensing and mapping at the Spiro Mounds. And that will be happening on March 7th. You can call Mary Quass at 575-6549 to find out more.
Excellent. So plenty of ways to celebrate Archaeology Month.
And if you're looking for fun tonight, Yonder Mountain String Band's in town.
Oh.
Where are they?
They are at George's at 9 o'clock, and it's $22.50. Really? Yonder Mountain String Band.
Yeah.
It's a bargain. Go have a good time.
All right. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Earlier, we heard from a representative of the Red Cross in a nod to American Red Cross Month. Our Sunday morning montage this week honors people, movies, songs, and legends with a connection to red. See how many of these you can identify.
You and I in a little toy shop, buy a bag of balloons with the money we've got, set them free at the break of dawn, to one by one. They were gone. Back at base, box in the software, flash the message. Something's out there, floating in the summer sky. 99 red balloons go by.
Did you wish to enroll for one of our courses, Mr.
Kadiddlehopper, Clem Kadiddlehopper.
How do you spell that name?
C-L-E-M, Clem.
Re-verify our range to target.
one ping only. Captain, I just... Give me a ping, Vasily. One ping only, please. Aye, Captain.
I guess I should know by the way you popped your car sideways. I don't mean that. So you're the kind of person that believes in making out once, love them and leave them fast.
Oh, Grandma!
Acting negatively. They want to see Maris get something he can swing on.
The red-headed stranger from Blue Rock, Montana rode into town one day, and under his knees was a raging black stallion, walking behind was a bay.
Well, keep fighting this.
Will you tell Max I'd like a picture of myself in the magazine? And under it, I would like the words deported. In 1919, the government of the most powerful country in the world is afraid of this woman.
We're gonna get you back, Iggy. The revolution needs you. We're gonna get you back.
After the turn of the century, in the clear blue skies over Germany, came a roar and a thunder men have never heard, like the screaming sound of a big war bird. Up in the sky, a man in a plane, Baron von Richthofen was his name. 80 men tried, and 80 men died, now they're buried together on the countryside.
To see a list of the 10 clips included in this morning's montage, please go to OzarksAtLarge.com.
Good morning. It is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, March 4th, 2013. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And joining us now is Katie Henriksen. She is host of Note throughout the week and on Sundays, Sunday Symphonies.
Good morning.
Morning. Hello.
What's on this evening?
So we are highlighting Verdi's Requiem this weekend. Of course, that is a very famous work, and it's something that you'll be able to hear in if you're in our listening area, because SONA, the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas, has a Masterworks 3 concert coming up March 9th, and they'll be performing Verdi's Requiem, featuring guest soloists and the SONA singers and regional choirs. So I like to play music that you're going to be able to hear live in our area.
So they're singers, so... How does singing fit into a symphonic work?
It's not a symphony. It's a requiem mass.
Okay.
But it a requiem has it uses a symphony as the accompaniment to the singers. So this recording actually is going to feature the Boston Symphony Orchestra led by Eric Leindorf, and it features the Boston Chorus Pro Musica, directed by Alfred Nash Patterson. There's symphonies like Beethoven's Ninth, which you know as a symphonic work,
right,
that has choral elements. But the Requiem and other works like that, they have they're predominantly choral and also have soloists, but they really need an orchestra to accompany them, as opposed to just a pianist or a small ensemble.
And this is why she's the music producer.
This is why she's the music producer, and we are not.
Right.
But this is a good chance if Verdi's Requiem is a really famous work. So, but if you haven't had a chance to hear it before and you're going to the concert, SONA's concert, this is a really good opportunity for you to familiarize yourself with the work.
Why would you say it's important to be familiar with the work before you go and hear it played?
You know, I go either way. Actually, you just experience it differently.
Mm-hmm.
I've gone to concert, many concerts where I'm not really that familiar with the repertoire, and it can wash over you, and it's like this amazing experience because you're unfamiliar with it. If you go to a concert and you are really familiar with the work, then there's a lot of different things that can happen. You can be really excited because you like the interpretation, or you can be a little upset because you're like, hey, that's not the way I like this piece to be done. But with a large work like a symphony, or in this case, Verdi's Requiem, it's a huge work and there's lots of elements going on. So it gives a listener a chance to kind of just get acquainted with this, what's a huge, huge work. And then when you go to the performance, you might actually notice things that you wouldn't have noticed had you not been familiar at all with the work itself.
Okay, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. Okay, so Verdi, tell us a little bit about this piece.
Well, Verdi's dates are 1813 to 1901, and a little bit about, from the liner notes, this is what the liner notes say about this recording. Like all geniuses inspired, Verdi at once, with one stroke, a few bars, puts us under the dread spell of the Requiem Mass. So, and also, you know, a Requiem Mass, it's a Requiem. It's solemn. It's like on the occasion of, I mean, a Requiem Mass is after someone dies. It's mm-hmm. basically what Requiem Masses are for. Of course, in the classical tradition, Mozart actually played Mozart's Requiem recently, and so they become known as works that you hear as musical works, as opposed to just something that's performed for someone's funeral or.
Well, tune in tonight for Sunday Symphonies with Katie Hendrickson.
Thanks. A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Crosses.
Crosses. Mm-hmm. Okay, I know where that is. That is towards Elkins, past Elkins.
Uh-huh, it's south of Elkins in Madison County.
Okay. I feel like there's a creek or something there that I used to go to. Do you know anything? Have you been to Crosses?
I've been through it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Crosses Creek, maybe?
Maybe. I don't know.
I'm not really sure.
Weekend Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And to end, we're going to play a song called Hiding and Seeking by a local band, Little Chief, who you talked to.
I did. They were recently in the studio to talk to myself and Kyle Kellums, and their new EP, Somewhere Near the River, officially came out on Friday. So
okay.
You can download it on iTunes, and the EP includes this song called Hiding and Seeking.
Okay, from Little Chief. Thank you so much for listening, and have a good Sunday.